Good evening, everyone. My name is Claire, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Brian. I'd like to thank Katie and the committee for the honor and the privilege to be asked to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you, which is always a privilege and an honor. It tells me that one more day I've celebrated life. It's but by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that this has been possible. I saw the countdown last night, and I welcome those of you who are new and to Alcoholics Anonymous and hope that you will keep coming back. It's been a wonderful experience here, and I'd like to thank all of you for your wonderful hospitality, and I had the privilege today to be escorted around your lovely city, and it's always a miracle for me to go to places and look back from where I came, and it's always just been, I'm always excited. And I walk into rooms like this, and I see your smiling faces, and I feel one more time like I'm standing in the sunlight of the Spirit. And by the grace of Alcoholics Anonymous and God, as I understand God today, this is indeed a miracle. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a wineette. And in the big book, which is the basic text of our program, it describes the insane things we continue to do in more about alcoholism in chapter 3. And it lists those insane things. And some of us, you know, just don't want to do step 1, 2, and 3. But in that list, it says we switch to natural wines. Man, I switched to Ripple. Now, that's not one of your natural wines. I don't think a single grape has ever been near that stuff. I think they just put some chemicals in a ball and they shook it up real hard. Probably put a little Kool-Aid to give me a choice of whether I should have the red Ripple or the white Ripple. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was doing a dance with death. And it was still in the paper bag. When I sat at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, April the 9th, 1974, it's 22 years and 4 months and some days ago, I was indeed sick of living but scared to die. I had drank my way to South Central Los Angeles in the ghetto, and it never occurred to me that 27 years before, and I'd been a daily drinker for those 27 years, that I would end up in South Central. Sometimes in a fetal position on a dirty floor with two young children that had no choice into where they had to go, but they had to go with a drunken mother because that's where I took them. And my alcoholism had affected the lives of every single person that loved me. And they loved me enough that they had to walk away from me and let me start that dance with death in that ghetto with drawn drapes, and I'm sure that I was doomed to die. Living off food stamps and welfare, I had drank away everything that was near and dear to me. Successful business career, the house, the cars, and all of those outside pleasures of life that was supposed to make me fit and know that I was somebody. And I would come to out of blackouts. I'm a real alcoholic, just the type that's described in the book. Come to very often at 10, 11 o'clock at night, sitting in an overstuffed chair with a terrycloth robe on and a bright red wig that had bangs. Many times, you know, I'd come out of the blackout and I'd see myself in the bang, and that wig would be on sideways. But I could hear the sound of my heart pounding like a drum. Very often I could feel my heart beating so rapid that it would feel like it was going to explode. And I come from the jazz world, Boston, New York, and Harlem for many years, and I knew what would fix that. See, by this time, I was drinking, couldn't get drunk, couldn't get sober, couldn't just stop drinking. And Dr. Silkworth, in the front of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, calls that insanity. And I would get up and out of that chair and get dressed to go to the nearest sleazy bar and crawl up on a stool so I could listen to the music. And I could hear that empty laughter, not the kind of laughter that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous that comes from the heart, and it's part of our healing. But I need to hear the music. Crawl up on that stool, and I'd always need a couple of drinks to give me the courage. See, I drank for years and years and years just to give me the courage to function in life. And I would always look to my right or my left, and I want to tell you something. There was always an intellectual sitting there. I met a lot of out-of-work airline pilots, a few neurosurgeons. I remember one night I'm sitting on that stool, and this guy sitting next to me looked over, and he said, you know, I'm a retired, he was probably in his 30s. He said, I'm a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. And then he looked around again. I knew we were in for a military secret here. He said, actually, he said, I do secret surveillance flying at night around the world. And he cupped his mouth and he whispered in my ear and he said, last night I actually flew over Russia. I said, I know, darling, I was with you. And then we proceed to get acquainted, and those are the kind of relationships I had by that time. And by the end of the evening, we were both legends in our own heads. And somewhere in that interim, I would end up going into a blackout and being dumped very often in the front yard. And then I was living in a neighborhood, and it was not about community, and I didn't go down there to become sociably accepted in that community. I was dumped in tall, wet grass at that awful hour of the morning, 3, 4, 5 o'clock, and it was always so cold, and it was always so dark. And it always seemed darkest, you know, right before dawn. And in California, in the springtime and in the summer, night birds come out around midnight. And I'm stretched out in the grass listening to birds calling back and forth to each other, and dogs travel in packs. Because they don't have owners, and those litters are dropped in some of that tall grass in those back alleys and in those storefronts. And I'm laying there in the grass and watching them truck by looking for food. See, in the ghetto, it's all about survival. You know, man or animal, you know, it's all about survival. And in those days, they had metal trash cans, and they put them out on the sidewalk, and it would take several of these little dogs to shove the can into the street. And I could hear the can when it would hit the ground and the lid began to roll. And it seems at that hour of the morning, when it seems as if the whole world was asleep, and I could hear my heart pounding, and the lid would quiet down to silence, and I'd make a few deals with God. Now, if you come from the streets in the fast lane, you know about making deals and when it was time to do that. And I would make God some of those promises that I would always have to break. I promise God, if you just, you know, get me off the ground this morning, I'm never going to drink like this again. And that face of that little 8-year-old daughter would come in before me, and I could remember her looking at me with that look that children look at a parent, you know, when they're disappointed because they never tell them the truth. And she say things like, you know, Mom, you know, you always promise you're going to come to PTA meeting. All my friends' parents always show up, but you don't come because you get drunk. And I would be looking at her and crying silent tears because I had to break the promise one more time, but I pat her on the head and I said, darling, but next time. But what she didn't know is when I took a drink, the drink took me. And then I gave it the power because I couldn't stop drinking. But I tell God, you know, look, you know, if you just let me get through this day, I'm going to go to PTA meeting. I'm 22 years sober and 4 months and some days, and I haven't been to a PTA meeting yet. What would happen is a phenomenon of craving would start. Dr. Silkworth says that we suffer from the phenomenon of craving, and when my eyes were open, I needed to drink. I'd get up off that ground, try to brush the dew off my shoulders, straighten up that wig, look around, see who's looking. Looking good almost killed me out there. I don't know about you guys, but I had a lady in my neighborhood that lived directly across the street from me, and I don't think that woman ever slept. It seems to me every time I looked over there, I knew she was there because I didn't see her face, but I could see her little curtains moving back and forth any hour, day or night. And when I'm standing out there in that wet grass, I look over there and I know she's there, you know, I give her the finger. Then I'd yell over there and the horse she rode in on. Then I'd turn and I'd, you know, would go up those few little steps there and I'd walk straight. God forbid she should think I'm drunk. I'd get through that door and lean on that door and I was dying. Physically, emotionally, and spiritually dying. Eating my meals by that time and I knew it was coming, that kind of sick vial that comes up and you know, I start there and I try to get down that hall to that bathroom in a hurry, get there, get on my knees in front of the toilet bowl, do a few chin-ups on the rim, sliding around on that cold porcelain trying to find a comfortable place to rest. It reminds me of this story. It was in this church and the minister said to the congregation, does anybody in here know where God is? And this little 9-year-old boy raised his hand and he said, I know, preacher. He said, the minister said to him, well, how do you know? He says, well, he said, every night my daddy comes home drunk. Comes up the steps, goes down the hall, goes into the bathroom, gets on his knees in front of the toilet bowl. And when I pass that door, I can hear him in there saying, oh, God. And I'd be leaning on that cold porcelain talking about, oh, God, and pass out one more time in that fetal position, come to with the room spinning. Did you ever have that experience where nothing will stay still? And I would try to focus on something that would stop the spin, and the two words that always greeted me was American Standard. Get up off that floor and break the promise that I told those kids that Mama wasn't going to go down to the local liquor store tomorrow. See, it was always about tomorrow, never today. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is just one day at a time. But I could never see anything past one day. It always was tomorrow or next week or next month or next year. And a phenomenon would start, and I'd get up off that floor and pull on those tight jeans. I was 65 pounds overweight, put on my bad leather jacket, put on some starfire earrings that hung to my shoulders. My mode of transportation by this time was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. Slip past the door so I won't wake the kids up. Feeling that feeling of pitiful, incomprehensible. demoralization and crying those silent tears and feeling that guilt and that shame at what my life had become, and I had no idea that alcohol had anything to do with it. Get to that door and open it quietly and sneak down those steps feeling like a thief in the night. Cross the street past three houses, get down on the avenue. Lean on the liquor store door and watch the world come alive on the cold winter mornings and see the headlights of the cars where people who are responsible for their lives and themselves and the people they love and all the people around them, and they were going off to do whatever it took. And I'd been there, done that. But I wait for the man to come. Finally, this guy would show up with this ring of keys, and I'm trying to be cute. Well, you know, I hadn't been cute for a long time by now, and you don't have exactly smell too grand. With ripple coming out of the pores of your skin, it's not. Trust me, it's not Chanel number 5. And finally, he'd get that door open, and I'd follow him in there and stand at that counter, watch him put the change away. And finally, you know, it's something about clerks early in the morning in the ghetto. I think they're a little bored too, but sometimes they like to play games. See, I knew all about playing the game of life. I just didn't know how to live it. And some mornings he's asked me dumb questions. What are you going to have this morning, sweetheart? So now, look, man, if I wasn't having a good morning, I'd say to him, now, look, man, let's not play games this morning. I didn't get up this early to come down here for milk. You just put that wine in that bag and you let me go. And he'd stand there with his elbow on the counter and he'd play with the top of the bag. And there I would just have to reach across that counter, throw my 59 cent on that counter and start to walk out of there. By the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm involved in H&I work in this program for many years. And I get the privilege and the honor to take meetings and panels to prisons, hospitals, and jails in the Los Angeles area and in other parts of California. And I was sharing this story at Tehachapi one night, and this young man was in the back of the room, and he raised his hand, and he said, "Lady," he said, "ripple's gone up." He says, $1.18 now. I said to him, look, baby, I'm just glad I quit while I was ahead, you know. But I would just take it out of his hands and get out of his sight and pass a little plate glass window and lean on the building. See, my days of fine drinking had long been over. I didn't have to worry about bottle openers and proper cocktail napkins and stirrers, crystal glasses in the faces of smiling, handsome men. I didn't have to worry about that anymore. You know, and I would just take a hit off that wine. It would quiet me down inside, stop the shaking, and stop me from bouncing. Dr. Silkworth says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. But by this time, it wasn't about effect. It was just about me staying alive. I was drinking just to stay alive. Get back to that house and sit in that overstuffed chair and see the dawn really come up. Probably feeling like the man who said, "I had a dream last night, that life was passing me by. I was no longer in the dreams of life. I'm sitting in a chair dying because I can't stop drinking." Hear those kids go off to school and they with their heads down as they pass the door. And I'm sitting in the chair and, you know, we tell our stories in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, in a very wonderful, fine family. I'm the youngest of 7 children. My parents were not alcoholics, and my 6 brothers and sisters were not and are not alcoholics and are not responsible for the fact that I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Silkworth says we have a threefold disease, a physical allergy coupled with an obsession of the mind and a spiritual malady. And when I was very little, you know, I knew that right away that I didn't really belong here. I'm probably one of the ones that was born restless, irritable, and discontented. Right out of the chute, you know, I probably could have used a little drinky-poo in the first grade. I became a 101-proof bourbon drinker. And a little bourbon on the rocks in the first grade just to get me to the second grade. You know, it would have been wonderful. It would have kept me quiet and would have made me feel those feelings that I have learned to feel in Alcoholics Anonymous by the grace of God. You know, that I never have felt those feelings of low self-esteem and low self-worth, but I always remember as a little girl, and that's just the way I felt, and there was no need. My father was a very successful businessman. He was also a full-blooded Cherokee Indian who was born on a reservation in Cherokee, North Carolina, and who had gone to Georgia at around 20, 21 years old, and he was a craftsman and an artist, and he made a fine living for us. And, you know, I have made my amends, as it says in the book. It tells us about being willing to go to any lengths. And at 6 years sober, I got on a plane and left L.A. and went back to Atlanta for the first time after I left there, and went to the cemetery and had a long talk with my parents. Told them how sorry I was at all the pain I had caused them. And I hope if we meet again, it was going to be a reunion of joy and love. You know, and it was important for me to do that. And I had a lot of problems growing up, and when in my senior year at Booker T. Washington High School, I won an art scholarship that took me out of Atlanta. See, I was always in trouble. I was in trouble in that church. I have nothing against the church today. I was a strong Baptist family, and I studied the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and We Agnostics, and I have no problems with that. I found the God of my understanding in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at the time, I had a great deal of fear about their God. So what I did is, you know, I waved my finger at Atlanta as I was sitting on a train going to Boston, to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts, and I knew it was going to be different. It never occurred to me that I was taking me with me. Then I was going to have those same fears, and I walk into that school, and I didn't belong there either. And I was always filled with secrets. I heard a man at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous say one night, you know, we are as sick as our secrets. And when we do that fourth step and that fifth step, and we hold back the secrets, you know, it will just keep us sick if we don't share it all and begin to trust someone with those secrets. But my secret coming from that religious family was that I never really wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be in the performing arts. I wanted to be a performer. Now, I know my life was always full of fantasies because I don't know how I ever got into that one. Because I can't sing and I can't dance. But it seemed like wonderful, you know, that it would be wonderful to be up on that stage. So I hooked that school because I wasn't comfortable in there with those talented people. And I knew I was never going to be able to stand up to the expectations of people that I was going to, you know, do something with that talent. So I hung out in the movies a lot. And I carried a bag lunch just so, you know, I could hide. I could hide from people and I could hide from, and nobody would know how afraid I was, you know, just being in amongst people. I was always terrified of people, and I want to tell you, it always amazed me because they were everywhere, you know. I couldn't get rid of them, you know, and so I could hang in the movies in the dark, and I loved jazz music, and one night I was walking down the street with another student, a young lady who was a friend, and we passed this door, and these people walked out, and I heard this music. And I said to her, let's go in there and see what they do in there. Now, when I grew up in Georgia, I don't know about now, but when I grew up in Georgia, it was a dry state. They didn't have package stores. I'd never seen alcohol. I don't recall ever seeing anybody drunk. And even after I got to Boston, I just didn't know that alcohol was on the planet Earth. But She said, that sounds like a good idea to me. So he go into this room. It was a jazz club. And it was dimly lit. And the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze. And down at the end of the bar was this rather portly lady. And she was grinding out this blues. And my heart started beating really fast with excitement. And that feeling of living on the edge. You know, in L.A., I'm a bumper sticker watcher. And recently I was in Beverly Hills and the car in front of me said that if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much space. I love that. I sat on this bar stool and the bartender leaned over with a petulant smile. And he said, what are you going to have to drink? Well, I didn't know. Well, I remembered in the movies they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip-slick cool act. And I leaned back on that bar and I said, we'll have a martini, honey. I said, and make it dry. I had no idea what a dry martini was. But they always said that in the movies. This guy turns around, he puts these two stem glasses up there and he even it out, looked like lemonade. And when I was growing up in Georgia, we drank a lot of lemonade in the summertime. Now, I didn't know you're supposed to sip drinks. I pick up that little stem glass, looked around, opened my mouth and dumped it. I was a pig from the gate. But I remember the way it made me feel. And I am sure with that first drink that the light of my soul began to dim. It took me 27 years later on a dirty floor in South Central. And I made that call to Alcoholics Anonymous that the light began to come on. I stepped out on that floor. I'm probably 19, 20 years old, had never had a date. Terrified of boys, and I'm still holding the glass. I hooked up right away with some new friends. The pimps, the hookers, the madams, and the bad boys. And I learned what it takes to walk the walk and talk the talk. You know, and they talk about street life, and I still love jazz music. It's an old song now. I'll paraphrase the words when it's about street life. It says, if you're young, don't get old in the streets. Because the cold's going to hit you in the back. You're going to nickel and dime your life away. You're going to look back one day, it was all a masquerade. Because what you have to do in the streets, you have to learn to play the role. And I learned to play it, and I learned to play it well. And there, I'm sure I came to many, 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 many turns in my life during that time. And it seems to me that a lot of those roads that I took out there in those streets, you know, was self-destructive every single time. I met a nice young man who came from a similar background. He didn't know much about drinking either, and we learned to drink together. And I stopped going to that school most of the time because I was in jazz clubs every night. It was a wonderful time if you're going to start drinking to start when I started in the midst of the jazz era. And I was in those clubs every single night, the likes of the late Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis and Sarah Vaughan and Dinah Washington, the great blues singer, the greatest blues singer of our time, and Billie Holiday. And I get to be very friendly with Billy and hung out with Billy a lot of nights. And it was exciting. And we got married and we played the streets together because we both liked the same things. And we had a little son and we shoved him off on his grandparents to raise. And, you know, I began to understand what pain was about when I would have to go visit that little boy as he was growing up. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes a kind of alcoholic practicing my disease when it says selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles. And it goes on in that paragraph to say that we are driven people. We are driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And when I'd go visit that little boy and he would look at me with that look, You know, that was the beginning of that look of being a disappointed child. And he said, "But Mom, you told me last week when you came, you were going to take me to the park this week." And I said, "I know, baby, but next time." See, because I'd have to get out of his eyesight because it was too painful to watch him watch me. You know, Dr. Silkworth said, there's a little line. He says, the alcoholic, you know, there comes a time when we can't differentiate the difference between the truth and the false. And I'd get out of his sight and get back down on those bar stools. You know, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous from many inventories that, you know, I was just greedy and selfish and self-centered. You know, and I was always looking for something better. And anything excitement in my life lasted about 2 weeks. And I had to go find something else, trying to fill up that hole, that dark hole inside. And, you know, money couldn't buy it, you know, and all that laughter and all the great names of the jazz world at the time didn't fill it up. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and this program that told me that what would fill it up. And that's where the light of my soul came on when I thought God could and would have sought. And what I did is I was sitting on a bar stool early one morning with Billie Holiday, and we were drinking. And I mentioned their names because it was very important time of my story at the time when I first started drinking. And my husband's family, you know, in this family business, he traveled a lot. So I'm sitting there talking to Billie. And, you know, I was looking for a man that I had named in my fantasy. And I called him Mr. Wonderful. I knew he was out there somewhere, and if you hang out in Boston, New York, and Harlem long enough, they show up. And I'm sitting there on the stool with chatting, and I look up, and he's standing there, and he has a black hat turned down all the way around, has a top coat over his shoulders. He's so cool, he can't get his arms through the sleeves. And he looked down at me and he closed one eye. He reached in his pocket, pulls out this roll of money, peeled off 10 $100 bills, spread it like a deck of cards, and whispered, "Spend it." Now, I didn't believe in God. But he sure had answered my prayer on this one. And I was already into step two and didn't know it. Because Mr. Wonderful turned out to be the head of the mafia. The Boston family. I learned that kind of lifestyle of riding in a limousine with bodyguards, with sawed-off shotguns and all the armor on the floor. Totally insane. That husband and I hung out in those streets, and one morning, one beautiful Sunday morning, sitting in that car, and we were all hungover, and we were stopped at a red light. I looked across the street, and on the corner stood young families with their little kids all dressed up the way my parents used to dress me up when I take me off to church on Sundays. And they were crossing the street to this beautiful New England church. I looked over, and there it was. And something like washed over me, like a voice said to me, "Clara, something's wrong with your life." And I agreed. The problem was Boston. If I just get out of Boston, get away from these hoodlums and this lifestyle, and we picked up the little son who was about 10 years old by this time, and we moved to California. We moved into the Los Angeles area, had two more children, went into a little small business because we went with good intentions. We bought a case of Old Crow, put it in the trunk of the car, and drove across the country, and we drove into Los Angeles, and we said to each other, "We're going to be better parents." Now, I stayed in that marriage and that relationship for 24 years. I think it was one of the sickest relationships that two human beings could have been in, and I've done an inventory on every person that was on my list. I did an individual inventory on what part I played in that poor person's life that caused them to harm and caused me to feel the way I felt about myself. And, And in that relationship, I realized that we were two very sick people and we were too sick to leave each other. So we stayed in our own madness. And it got worse, as it says in the book, it always will. I'd reached that point, you know, where I couldn't stop drinking. That business was getting successful. And I had those three kids. That older son was 10 years older than the two younger ones born in California. And I began to lose it all. My family had been very successful in their careers, moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, and they began to talk about my drinking, and I was out of control. And I never thought I'd stand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, thank you, God, that you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed, because I needed to get sober. And I needed to find a God of my understanding. I simply needed to stop dying. And I went to a sister because, you know, the Internal Revenue took the business. The husband was gone because of my violent behavior. And in blackouts, I'd started having those blackouts by that time. And the marshal was putting the lock on the door, uniform marshal, putting a big lock on it because the bank had foreclosed on my beautiful house. And I'm standing on the sidewalk because I'd gone to my sister, my last hope. And I said to her, please help me save the house. And she looked at me. You know that look with people who love you? And they look back at you and you can see in their eyes, you know, the eyes are like the window of the soul. And I looked at that sister who was a nurse and she said, it pains us to watch you live the way you live. We don't know what to do with you because we love you. But we're not going to sign any more checks and we're not going to bail you out of any more trouble. And I'm sure that my loving God was beginning to work in my life through them. She said, but I tell you what I'm going to do for you because we love you is we're going to pray for you. And I've come to believe in the power of prayer. And I looked at her and went back and ended up standing on that sidewalk, but that son was 18 years old by now. And he stood there. He was so handsome. And he said to me, look, I am not going to the ghetto with you. I don't even know who you are. And I'm standing there looking at him and screaming inside, if you only knew how I feel. I don't know how to tell you I love you. I wish I knew how to tell you that. The only kind of love I knew about was in the streets, and it was always for sale. I never knew how to reach out and touch those children, and I can tell you the truth because you're not going to judge me. But I never wanted anybody else to know that. I just simply didn't know how to do that. And he says to me, you know, tears in his eyes, but they didn't run. I guess it wasn't macho for an 18-year-old young man to cry over a drunken mother who was beginning to wake up with strangers for the price of a drink. And he turned and walked out of my life, and I stood there with that alcoholic behavior and arrogance. And I said, and screw you too. And I turned and picked up that bag and ended up down there in that ghetto. And ended up with strange people at strange times. Most of that 2 or 3 years that I was down there. One morning, one more time, God trying to get my attention because I was beginning to get battered in the streets while under the influence. And I ended up in the hospital, Daniel Freeman Hospital, in a little area called Inglewood. In that place, another Sunday morning, God trying to get my attention. And paramedics, people who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. How many times did I sit in that overstuffed chair, contemplating suicide only to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous that suicide is a final solution to temporary problems. And I've learned how to resolve my problems through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that those steps were spiritual in principle and honoring the traditions of this program. And I look up Police are at the foot of the bed. There were two nuns standing by the bed, an older nun and a young nun about 23 years old. That older nun wasn't pleased with me at all. I mean, I was giving her a lot of lip. And I always gave people a lot of lip, and I was always hostile when I was in situations like that because I didn't want people to know how afraid I was. And when I gave them a lot of lip, they turned and walked away from me in disgust. So she had on horn-rimmed glasses, she had dark eyes, and she had her hands in those sleeves, and she was so angry because I wouldn't tell the police who had done that to me at that moment. I said, you know, I didn't want them to know I didn't know. So she turned and she stormed out of the room, but the young nun stood there, and I've come to believe in earth angels. That young nun couldn't have been over 23 years as old as she stood there. And she looked down at me and she began to cry. The spiritual being that she is. I've come to believe that we are all born spiritual beings and we search for our humanness in this journey of life. And those tears hit the covering of that bed. And she didn't say to me things like all the people who love me said, why don't you stop drinking? She said, how did you ever let your life get into such a state? And I looked up at her, and that had been a bad one because I remember a pair of black cowboy boots that had cleats on the toes. And I was on the sidewalk as they kicked me around in the gutter. Kicked me in my head, and I had a brain concussion. I remember being kicked in the ribs, and I could still hear them cracking one at a time. See, I know about pain, I know about physical pain, and I know about emotional pain, and that pain has no memory. I kept living the life of the jaywalking, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, totally insane. Kept doing insane things in the streets with insane people and expecting the different results. They take me up with 2-inch wide adhesive tape, and 3 days later, that same young nun, I believe God appointed her, who assisted me to the front door of that hospital, and she stood quietly with her arms around her, that compassionate being, and she just looked at me gently and said, try not to drink today. And I'm an alcoholic because I was bent over because I was in so much pain I couldn't stand up straight. Went to the nearest liquor store. And 3 weeks later, while I'm behind drawn curtains, you know, like healing one more time, I don't know what happened that morning on April the 9th. I came to on a dirty floor. The miracle was there was no stranger there. The men in my life by that time had faces and no names. I believe what happened to me was a divine intervention. And that God kissed me gently and said, child, get off the floor. You don't have to live like an animal again. Bill Wilson, the co-founder of our program that I believe was divinely inspired. And when Bill Wilson, who was also agnostic, talked about his spiritual experience when he called Dr. Silkworth, who was treating him for alcoholism, he even questioned his own sanity from that experience. And he told a good doctor, he said, if something's happened to me, it's like a clean wind blowing through and through as if from the top of a mountain. And he summed it up by saying, he supposed God come to most men gradually, but his impact upon him had been sudden and profound. And that was my experience on that floor that morning. I called a friend who told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never in my life heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. All of my fair weather friends that I had drank and with and wined and dined and bought all the love that I could afford out there were all dead from our disease. And I started to, I just kept, you know, I stood there on that floor and she said, call them. I don't know what they do, but they stay sober. And I picked up the phone and asked the operator for Alcoholics Anonymous, and she put me right through. A man said, "Good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, dear." He said, may I help you? I said, "My name is Clara, and I can't stop drinking." And the truth was finally out. And it was an incredible feeling, that just that moment of being willing to tell the truth, I felt relieved. And what I had heard from a stranger on the phone that morning was hope. And that's what we're about in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're about hope. And he told me where to go to a meeting that night. And here I am living in the ghetto, and I'd always been so arrogant and so full of myself. I said to him, "Sir, do you have meetings in Beverly Hills?" He said, "No, there's a meeting not too far from you." And So I knew for some reason, you know, that I was going to go to that meeting. And I called my brother, and I told him I needed the car to go to a meeting, that I'd found a place for me. It was called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "Well, you can use the car. I'll bring it to you on my way home from work." And he said, "You keep it as long as you want to use it." And I could still hear him running up the stairs, and I was standing by the door. And when he came in, and he kissed me, and he said, "You know, I hope this is going to work for you. What's to do? We just keep praying." And he left the keys, and I started to get dressed that morning, and I hope I never had that experience to go to another Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, you know. But I'm standing there. I had never heard of the language, you know, like detoxing. I've learned the language in Alcoholics Anonymous is the language of the heart. And at 10 o'clock that morning, my body started jerking around, and I didn't know what was wrong, but, you know, the miracle was that I didn't go to the liquor store from the physical pain that was beginning to happen. I've come to believe in miracles because they're real, and happen to those who aren't afraid that they're real. And I looked in the closet on what to wear. I had to look good. I didn't know what you guys were about, and I had a red velvet dress. It's the only dress I had, and I'm leaning on the door trying to figure out what to wear. Had wine stains on the front of it. Got soap and water, a little brush, cleaned up the wine stain, got that wig out. Put her on that head foam, picked myself some better bangs and sprayed her up. Tell you, look, you know, I've been living on that wig for about 5 years. If that wig alone could have talked, it probably would have blackmailed me. But she was looking pretty good. Around 2 o'clock, I was really perspiring, and I was walking around like an animal in a cage in a zoo, you know, just bouncing. So I decided just to get out of the house. I went over to Woolworths and just to browse. While I was browsing, I stole some eyelashes for my first meeting. Now, they come quite long, and I didn't know you're supposed to trim them. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. At 7 o'clock, I'm standing in front of the mirror. You know, they come with a little tube of glue. And I'm squeezing that glue along the edge of that lash, and I'm bouncing, and I grab my elbow, and I stand in front of the mirror, and I wait for an opportune moment. I slam it in, and one ends up here, and one ends down there. I lean in the mirror. I said, "You looking good." And I went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat in that chair that night, and God had etched my name on that chair. And I had paid the price in the streets to sit there. As I sat there, I quickly reviewed my life, and what I saw was that alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity. It had stripped me of all moral values and all family values that I certainly had learned in that lovely family. You know, I was growing up, I just couldn't hear it. And they started a meeting, and they asked for the hands of the newcomer, and I didn't know what that was. And the lady behind me touched me on my shoulder and said, "Hey, raise your hands, honey, you're a newcomer." And at the coffee break, she gave me her telephone number and her name. She said, "My name is Carolyn. I'm going to sponsor you." And in those days, they had real coffee cups in all the meetings. And I went over and was trying to get some coffee in the cup. And, you know, I was shaking so badly, I had to put it down. And that lady became my sponsor that night. She's still my sponsor today at this very moment. And she's been not only my sponsor, my confidant, she's been my friend and my spiritual teacher. And she started me in those books. And then in 1974, there were about 20 of us who got sober together. We grouped together. We washed those cups. We cleaned our meetings. We became immediately in service, you know. And I learned right from the beginning that you never say no to an AA request. And we, out of that, 24 have passed away from natural causes, and the rest of us all sober. Not one ever went out. We are still in service, and we do what we do and what we were taught to do. And I was told to get a job by my sponsor. I wasn't too thrilled with that kind of news. I have no real skills, you know, and she said, "Well, I don't care what you do." She said, "But you get a job as long as it's honest." And I got a job as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress, and I spilled a lot of coffee on people who had a bad attitude. Couldn't figure out why nobody would tip me. Would go into my home group, and I bring you greetings from my home group, the Robertson Originals, that meet on Sunday morning. And I would whine and whine. I whined my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember being at a meeting one night, and after we said the Lord's Prayer and the Amen, this man came out of the back of the meeting, and he put his arms around me, and he said, "Clara, please come down off the cross." He said, "We need the wood." My sponsor got me into those steps, and I made those amends to my children, whose names were on the top of the list. And I remember going into that room with them, and my oldest son had left. He'd gone into the performing acting and television, and he was doing really very well, and he was very talented. And he came home when I was 2 years sober, and we all sat down, and I told him how sorry I had been that I hadn't been there for them those years they were growing up. And I told him how I really loved them in my heart. I just didn't know how to tell them that I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I didn't have to live like that again. And that I had learned that I was a sick person and not a bad person. I remember that son looked at me and he said, "Mother, that was yesterday." And he said, "We have no guarantee about tomorrow." And he said, "Let's all get on as a family." And I love that part in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, The Family After. My sponsor, I'm a double winner because my sponsor sent me to Al-Anon. And for my first 5 years, you know, I was very active in Al-Anon, learning how to be a parent and learning how to deal with my children at a sober level. And that darling little daughter of mine grew up. The grandparents kept sending her to the expensive training. And she was the first black professional ice skater that went into with Dorothy Hamill. And that was when I was 5 years sober. And I began to see the promises coming true. And that little 9.5-year-old son who had to go to that ghetto. When I was 7 years sober, he attempted suicide. Because I, with the help of my Al-Anon family and my AA sponsor and my women that I was sponsoring and my home group, you know, they kept telling me that I didn't have to, you know, have him living in my home, drinking and using drugs and not working. And it took a lot of courage. That's what it takes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my sponsor has said to me many times, in order to grow, we must do the things we fear and dread to do the most. And I had to get past the fear and ask him out of my house and change that lock and lean on that door and ask God to help him and to help us in the family. And when he attempted suicide, he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's today a sober member of this fellowship. He's home now because A year ago, this past June, he ate some contaminated chicken in a restaurant. He's paralyzed, and he has E. coli bacteria in his body. And he's home now, and we are, you know, he's slowly recuperating and recovering from it, and he'll never completely, you know, but it's all of you earth angels, and I ask you for your prayers, you know, that he will be all right. That older son went on to be quite successful in his career, and he ended up at ABC Television in New York. He was in the news department in the early 80s, and he began to shoot cocaine and share the needle around the table with, you know, in high places with high people, you know, doing his thing. I did mine with alcohol, and that's where he was, enjoying that success. He left there and never touched drugs again, moved back to Los Angeles, got married, had a little son. I have a little grandson, and his name is Aaron. And God has given me a second chance, you know, because I'm always there for Aaron. And I never promise Aaron anything that I don't do. When I say we're going to the park, we go to the park, man, you know, but mainly we go to Toys R Us. When I was, you know, and the marriage didn't last, and he moved out, and he moved up to Northern California where he was teaching performing arts at the college level. And then he called me one day, and we'd become very good friends. You know, if you haven't done that eighth and ninth step, do it. You know, it eases all that pain. And he called me and he said, Mom, I went to the doctor today for something and else they ran some tests and the tests came back and I'm HIV positive. And I couldn't believe it. And I do what I do and I hung up and I said, I'll be right there. I'll be there tomorrow. And I got on my knees and I asked God to help us, the family. I said, we can and you can. And the next day I was on a plane and I flew up to San Francisco and my son and I walked around that city with our arms around him and I hadn't been there for him when he was a little boy. And we talked about many things. We talked about life and we talked about death. And I had sponsored a young woman who was 8 years sober, and she died of AIDS, and she too had been an intravenous drug user and sharing the needle. I remember going to her and looking at her and holding her in my arms, and I pushed away and I looked in her eyes and I said, how do you feel about death? Because death had always been at the top of my fear list. And she looked at me and she said, death is not the greatest loss in life. The greatest loss is dying inside while you are still alive. And I walked. Walking around San Francisco with my son, I shared that with him. And he said, I don't want to come home now. He said, I'm feeling really well. And it took a while. And then I got that call that no one wants to call here. That call that said, Mother, I'm too sick to work. And I can't take care of my apartment anymore. And he said, I want to come home because it's time to die. And you don't know that kind of pain. I thought the pain that I suffered out there in those streets was the ultimate pain. But there is no pain when you hold the hands of a dying child. It's not supposed to be that way. And we had everything ready for him. And then I had gone back in that business that I drank away when I was 3.5 years sober. And I'm still in that business today, 18.5 years later. And I have a very big company today. And I take my daughter in 1990. I'd invited her into my company as a full partner. That's the little girl I couldn't go to PTA meeting with. She runs that business, and what it is property management and maintenance, and I've given her all the big buildings and the medical centers, and I learned to be a professional. I started off cleaning houses. in Beverly Hills. And I learned to do what I do, and I learned to do it well. And I practiced the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in all my affairs, and I don't lie and steal, and I don't steal anymore. You know, I'm respected in my profession today. And they were running the business, and I had many hours to sit by the bed of that son and hold his hand and see a handsome young man fade away into, from 165 pounds to 99 pounds and hear him screaming with pain. There's been a lot of loss in my life. A young man just last week from my home group died of AIDS. And my earth angels are the members of Alcoholics Anonymous and the women I sponsor who came and stood around that bed, and they helped him sing as he watched with us, and his eyes so filled with so much pain. And at 10:15, the morning before the earthquake, he was gone. That sound of the rasp of death was over. As I look back of all the ones that I love in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, some of you old-timers may remember the wonderful Alabama Carruthers, who would have had 39 years of sobriety, who was a model and a giant in this program 3 years ago or so. She was gone. And I pray that all of their souls rolled the wings of angels to a higher place where there's no more crying and there's no more dying and there's no more pain. And and he said, "Grieve for me, but let me go." And we got on with our lives, and he loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and he paid me a compliment that he certainly, you know, when I looked, I remember standing in front of that house, he said, "Mother, I love Alcoholics Anonymous because it's given us the mother we always wanted and the lady we always knew you could be." When I was about, I want to close about service and how we stay sober. After I went into that business, I got well. I was about 4 or 5 years sober, and I got, it's dangerous to get well in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't do it. I got, you know, I had, now I bought this nice Spanish house in the beautiful section of Los Angeles near the ocean, and I still live there, and I was beginning to slip away, as the book says, the insanity will return. Through all the pain, you know, my faith in God has not eased the pain in my life in sobriety, but my faith in God has sustained my sanity. It never occurred to me to take a drink ever when I have gone through these ups and downs of life. But that's what I've learned, and so I'm just beginning to feel good about myself. I got this high house. I go out and I buy not a little car that I could afford. I go out and I buy a white Eldorado. And you know, we always got to look good. And I was lying to my sponsor. One day I was in my living room on a Saturday afternoon dancing with a broom. And I was playing my Billie Holidays and remembering the good old days. Never once, we talk about insanity, never once occurred to me about leaning on the door in dark mornings waiting for the man to come. And the phone rang, and my God, my loving God, was getting my attention. It was a call from central office. Lady said, "Clara," she said, "we have a 12-step call." And I said, "What?" She said, "We have a 12-step call." I said, "Where is it?" She said, "It's on Skid Row." I said, "I don't think I'm qualified." To make a 12-step call on Skid Row. She got really annoyed for me. She said, "Oh, stop it." She said, "Just take a name," and she said, "It's a hotel." And she said, "You go down there and you make that 12-step call. You know, that she said, God is God is knocking on your door, you know, and you go, and you do God's work, not God's job. And you go, call my sponsor. I said, Carol, you know, I just got a call from central office. They want me to go down on Skid Row to make a 12-step call. And I said, I don't really think I can do it. And I said, you know, and no response from her. But I knew she was breathing. I could hear her. I said, look, I just don't want to do it. And she said, I don't care what you don't want to do. You do it anyway. And she hung up. Then I heard you never go on a 12-step call alone. So I'm sponsoring this little Hollywood actress. She has 90 days. I pick up the phone, call Beverly Hills. I said, we're going on a 12-step call. She said, where? I said, down on Skid Row. She said, oh, I don't want to do that. I said, I don't care what you don't want to do. I said, you get over here. She comes over my house, and we get this address, and we're both fussing all the way downtown. And the lady at central office had told me, said, I want to tell you, she said, it's the hotel doesn't have a name on the outside, but it has an address. It was not part of the Hilton chain, I'll tell you that. So we parked about that far from the curb because there's wine glass balls and broken balls all along the curb there. And I park out here. I want to cut up my tires. And we go into this lobby. And this was my spiritual awakening, as the 12-step talks about. We walk in there, and all these drunks are in there. There was romance going on in that lobby because they had a transistor radio up on the shelf. They had the boombox turned up as loud as it would go. And these couples were in there dancing and smooching around, and urine was all over the floor. And the stench was awful. And there was a red arrow along the wall, and they had a bell, a little sign above the bell that said, ring this bell for attention. And I rang the bell, and this clerk came from nowhere, and he said, yes. I said, you have somebody in here named Dorothy. Oh, my God, he said, she's up on the third floor. He said, now you take that elevator. You go up on the third floor. There's no numbers in this hotel, but she's at the end of the hall. So we go down the end of the hall. We had stepped over three drunks passed out. We just stepped over them. It's a little narrow hall, and we get to the end of the hall, knock on the door. A little boy said, come in. And on the floor in that hotel, the room about 6 by 8. I'm not good at figures, but it was a small room. 20-year-old, beautiful, blonde young woman in a fetal position, drowning on her own vomit. Had lost all body control. God gave me the privilege to see, you know, what this disease really is. And what it looks like on the floor when you're dying of alcoholism. And Constance and I looked at each other. Water bugs were so huge, as we walked around the room, they crunched. And they were all over her, and she lost all body control, and we cleaned her up. And I knew that God had me on a mission. And none of that arrogance was there. There was one alcoholic helping another alcoholic who was dying. We picked her up off that. She and I didn't say a word, and all our little glibness was out the window. We were silently picking her up and cleaning her up and put a little pink sweater on her. We got her between us, and she had her arms around both of us. We got her to the elevator, and we took her downstairs, and I called central office. I said, what do we do with her? And they told me where to take her, and we took her, and we registered her there, and we went into about two blocks down the street. There's a diner. It's still there. And we took her in there trying to sober her up. Was sitting in that diner, and for the first time in my life, you know, I began, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to talk about those steps from my heart. And I talked about the first step, and she was so drunk, and I said that, you know, that the first step, that we are powerless over alcohol, and that step comes in two parts, and the second part of that says that our lives are unmanageable, and she could relate to that. Then we talked about the second step, that God would restore us to sanity. And she talked about everybody in her family had either died or were dying of alcoholism or drug addiction. We got to the third step, and I said, we made a decision. Turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And she stood up and said, don't you talk to me about God. And I think I had some unresolved anger. I reached across that table and grabbed her by that sweater, pulled her far, going to punch her lights out. The book said having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, we carried the message. It didn't say beat them up if they don't want it. And I started going to see Dorothy every night after my business hours. And about the 12th or the 13th or 14th night, I went there, and they said she left last night and she hasn't come back. And I don't know where Dorothy is tonight, but she will never know that God put her there for me to see what I needed to see. And it changed the course of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized what it says, we are a program of action, and we're a program of service. And when all else fails, we work with another alcoholic. And I started some meetings on Skid Row that I still go, and I got really involved in this program. And that's what my life is about, 12-step work today. And I get the opportunity to get that phone call from lovely ladies like Katie, and they say, will you come and share with us? And I get on a plane, and I look out at the blue, and I'm grateful. I've learned that gratitude brings me humility, and humility brings me serenity, and serenity brings me peace. By the grace of God, in rooms like this, where you rendered me sober and you rendered me sane, and for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you, and God bless you.